That leads us into just concluding this wonderfully full chat with just some brief, as I said, lightning fire round type of questions on a few select movies that I did for research, because I'm sorry to say I didn't have time to watch all 40 plus movies of yours. I did some selection, but some of them were new experiences, which was great. I've not seen everything that of yours. So if we just go like randomly out of order, so BMX Bandits, which I gotta compliment you. I'm not a traveling man necessarily, but that widescreen frame and John Seale's eye and your eye made me want to go to Australia and Manly, New South Wales. That looked wonderful. And so my spontaneous question is, working with John Seale, like, any spontaneous words on that working relationship that lasted for four movies?
Oh, it was a wonderful relationship. He was the second unit cameraman on Man from Hong Kong. I was so impressed by him that I gave him his first full DP's job on Death Cheaters, which I had to make for $150,000. That was a 16mm blow up to 35. It has many flaws, and I think I've covered them a little bit in the DVD. And when the omnibus edition of my 70s work comes out through Umbrella Entertainment late in this year,
wow,
which will incorporate those movies that I made up until Stunt Rock, including Stunt Rock, then you'll be able to get that. It'll be region free. John Seale was he just had a natural gift for composition, and therefore. And I'd been working with Russell Boyd, another Academy Award winner, who similarly had a gift for composition. And I always loved CinemaScope movies, so I had my ideas about the framing in that ratio. So it was a joyous relationship with both of them. And I naturally wanted to make more films with John, and I couldn't think of a better person when I came to BMX Bandits than John Seale. And luckily, even though his fame was spreading, he came on board. And we'd done a bushfire fighting documentary in Scope prior to that in 1980, called Dangerous Summer, not the movie Dangerous Summer, but the little scene documentary that nonetheless played Australian cinemas to celebrate the courage of the bushfire fighting brigade. John, whose nickname in the crew was Sailor, because he loves to sail, he had that easygoing, relaxed attitude of, he synchronized well with my filmmaking is fun and the next shot is over here. We were very well attuned. And I've worked with many DPs, Ross Berryman, David Gribble, many Australian DPs, Mark Winden was a more recent one. They all have different personalities, but I found that they all meshed well with mine. Your DP he's your eyes, even though obviously now you don't actually you've got video assist to tell you whether the shot is working, but mm-hmm. in those days, you may have looked through the lens in rehearsal, but you relied upon your DP to say, yeah, the timing worked. Yeah, he hit the mark just as the camera came to a halt. Or no, we have to do it again because either he overshot the mark, or we were there ahead of him, or he slowed his pace, or whatever. Whatever made the tracking shot not quite be as beautifully synchronous with the action it was covering that we wanted. John Seale could always say, I know what you want, we didn't quite get it, let's do it again.
I love his cinematography on The Hitcher, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, where it's that wonderful scope frame. But there's something about how widescreen felt and versus how it feels now. It's so vastly different, for The Hitcher, which I can watch on a loop because it's like my infatuation with Rutger Hauer started with The Hitcher, and then knowing that John shot it, watching the documentaries on it. And yeah, yes, indeed, he comes through as a very very likable chap and a very energetic one as well. And it seems like it reflects in his work. It's not, he doesn't go from an angel to a devil sort of thing between set and interview. So it's good.
Yeah, he was wonderful. And look, I will work with, no doubt, if this picture in China actually goes, then I will be working with a Chinese DP, who knows who yet, that'll be a new relationship with a language barrier to transcend. But I think that my style and my personality will mesh with a gifted cameraman in any culture.
And again, just the final two or three brief ones here, jumping out of order. Night of the Demons 2, you mentioned, which I thought was so much fun. Just great genre fun, great gooey, gory fun. And it took a while for them to do a sequel for Night of the Demons, which surprised me. So, you know, you've done a couple of sequels and several ones in a series. Is there any general pros and cons, of directing horror sequels, or it's yet another project kind of thing?
My attitude to Night of the Demons 2 was to ramp up the comedy and maybe some of the absurdist humor. You know, I kind of like the idea of a demonized high school guy stabbing a priest to death while reciting the act of contrition. I mean, I know I'm a sick and wicked puppy, but, you know, I'm afraid that sort of thing amused me. Irony does play a part a lot in my view of life, though I love life, but I see some essential absurdities in what we are taught to believe. But so my attitude was, okay, there was some humor in the original, but, you know, let's find ways to ramp up the prosthetic makeup effects, and let's have more Catholic jokes. You know, just ramp up the humor. And I think that has made Night of the Demons 2 last as long as it has and be the best of the trilogy.
It seems like you weren't saddled with anyone saying, this is how you make a Night of the Demons movie, which I think speaks to the fact that they waited so long to do a sequel. So by that point, it seemed like you go ahead and be creative and create.
Well, the producers did have a strong view. I think initially in the development process, we kind of butted heads a little bit, or I butted heads with one of them anyway. In the end, I think they saw that my approach was working, or would work. And you know, the director has power primarily during the period of shooting. After that, you know, his power can be completely taken away from him. He can be kicked out of the editing room. Producers fashion the footage as they saw fit. You know, that happened to me on Atomic Dog, where, you know, it was a very flawed concept that I pointed out. They didn't agree, and I did it as well as I thought it could be done. And then they tried to re-edit it constantly, but they never could make it any better. I mean, ego does play a strong part in the film business. There are people who believe it, you know, my way is right. And to a certain extent, I believe my way is right, but I'm a collaborative filmmaker. I listen to people and then, you know, see if there is a middle course, if there is disagreement, or try and win the day with a successful argument.
Which is a rational approach to anything in life, which is logical and at the same time seems rare in different walks of life that people approach things rationally. But you certainly seem to believe that strongly.
Yes, well, I think while we live in an irrational universe, we must try to be as rational as possible. And as accepting of other people's points of view, but ultimately the film, a film, has to have a single vision. A committee can create that single vision, you know, and as brigade commander and, you know, group counselor and court jester, I will then carry out that vision, and I will, you know, most successfully if everyone is on board with it. I do my best work when people get my approach and, you know, support it.
And my next to last thing here, because I'm a great fan of Ollie Ermey, who's starting Visage of Firebase, Gloria. I mean, how much do you need to direct someone like Ollie, considering his real life experience, or does he want to be directed when he's on set?
Well, he does want to be directed. But he was the character. He'd served two terms of duty in Vietnam. He'd been invalided out after he'd got shrapnel in the shoulder, and therefore, the butt of his rifle was very painful when he fired it. But he was the real deal. I listened to him a great deal when he arrived. I took him to the location that I'd picked for the firebase.
You were in the Philippines for this one. Correct.
Yes, that's right. And he said that he approved, and he thought that the Filipino art department, who had done quite a few Vietnam films already, they'd just done Hamburger Hill.
Right. They did
a great job, very authentic. But in lots of areas, he said, I think it would be, it's more authentic if you do this. For instance, it was originally an army group, an army patrol that he headed. He said, it's much better if I'm a Marine, because then I can, the attitude of the Marines to the regular army is, sometimes a little combative. And if I have to lick this firebase into shape, I think it comes much better from a Marine. Mm-hmm. And the real tough guys. Now, there'll be some army guys who will counter that, but we work together on the script, and that's why we both get additional dialogue credit in the end credits of the movie.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, because I read something about that and remember that I didn't see anything at the top of the movie, and then I simply didn't read anything at the end. That makes sense, because it feels very him and also very authentic. And it's also nice after such a big performance in Full Metal Jacket for audiences to get this more subdued and down to earth and underplayed version of Ollie Ermey, which he was always great. He was a great comedic actor too. I loved him in The Frighteners.
Mississippi Burning and Fletch and so many, and Dead Man Walking. One of his most heartfelt and subtle performances. And of course, I hired him again for Megiddo, Omega Code 2.
Sweet. And finally, my friend, because this is primarily, but not exclusively, a podcast dedicated to Hong Kong cinema. So let's briefly get back to The Man from Hong Kong, because as people might not know, unless they listen to your commentary or read the cast list, you are in the movie. You're not just an extra in the background. You actually did a fight scene with Jimmy Wang Yu that feels quite brutal, and I like it a lot, and I like a gritty, brutal Hong Kong cinema fight from the 70s that feels loud and powerful. So my sort of naive fan geek question is, if it feels powerful on screen, was it powerful to shoot and impactful and even painful to shoot?
Firstly, I was in the film partly because of vanity, but also partly from economics. What I had written originally had a line of dialogue said by the martial arts gymnasium manager, overheard by Jimmy Wong Yu, who had sneaked in by climbing up the drainpipe, that was a confirmation to him that the bad guy played by George Lazenby, Wilton, was definitely up to no good, and was consignment of drugs was going to be delivered, etc. So he just needed that. He needed to hear that in the story for the connection to be made, and then of course he brushes past a sword, and it is a clink, and that character is alerted. They have a brief fight, after which that guy is punched through or disposed of, and I hadn't really written how he would be disposed of. But then when Jimmy runs out, this guy pursues him, and they fight on top of the elevator. That was the plan in the script. But then, when the Chinese co-production came on board, we realized we had to shoot 50% in Hong Kong and 50% in Australia. The corridor and elevator was in the distribution company that was backing that the Australian half of the co-production, and the gymnasium had to be built in Hong Kong. So that one-line character was in both locations, both sets, and therefore both countries. You wouldn't want to import, an actor for one line, particularly an actor who had to do a bit of stunt work and, let's say, do a fight on top of the elevator. And so I wanted to do a little bit of stunt work, and I had been, I'd been set on fire a few times, and I'd been, I'd had a little bit of experience, but I thought it'd be fun to be punched through glass or coffee glass. So that was going to be my demise in the Hong Kong sequence. And I had to shoot the Australian sequence first. So I come rushing out with, actually a really silly choice of weapon, the steel whip. And blood pouring from my head because I knew I was going to be punched through glass. And then I slide down the elevator cable and then fight with him on top. So I rationalized my vanity to a degree by saying, well, it was for economic purposes. I mean, I guess I could have rewritten it and written that one-line character out in another way. But I kind of wanted to be in a fight scene. Now, I wasn't very good in the fight scene, but I did the elevator one first. Jimmy's attitude was, well, okay, he wants to be in a fight scene with me. I will treat him as I treat any Hong Kong stuntman, which is a certain amount of contact.
You're in a Sammo movie to boot, and Sammo's ways of achieving power sometimes is through actual contact, as many people have testified and many people have praised, because it looks a little bit better on screen with a little bit more contact. So,
Yeah, and so, he did definitely kick me in the solar plexus, as he was meant to, and I wasn't quite ready for it. So it did actually have the effect of doubling me over without me having to act that.
Wow.
And then his stamping on my back was... Yeah, I mean, he could have stamped a lot harder, but it was hard enough.
Well, regardless where you were at with each other during the production, I'm not gonna squeeze you on that detail. The sequence is actually still impactful and powerful. It packs that Hong Kong cinema punch, which is what I like with Man from Hong Kong. It's not a watered down co-production that took away the power of the Hong Kong crew and made it their own. So that sequence very much plays a part of that, in my opinion. So job well done, my friend.
Well, Jimmy, you see, what I liked about Jimmy's style was that, and we did discuss this when he arrived in Australia, was I didn't want it to be a balletic kung fu movie like Shaw Brothers movies. I wanted a bit of street fighting.
Which is something Jimmy did so well in so many movies because of his background. He never you never saw him perform martial arts in a balletic style. I can't think of many movies, maybe some of his Taiwanese swordplay movies, but they were so batshit crazy, some of them. It was more about the supernatural aspect of them anyway. So so you're that's right in his wheelhouse, I think. And he did it so well. I mean, he never got old. I mean, say what you want about certain Wang Yu movies, but he really never got old when he bursts, whips into action.